The maze of pipes, tanks, and strange-looking mechanisms that Pitt and Giordino recognized as electrical generating equipment had to be a plumber's nightmare. A huge gear system with meshing steel teeth dominated the aft end of the room. While Kelly wandered about, not as fascinated by the machinery as the men, she came to a high podium-like table without a chair that held a large leather-bound book. She opened it and studied the old-fashioned scroll handwriting in brown ink. The book proved to be the chief engineer's log. The last entry was dated June 10, 1901, and read, "Close down the engine for the final time. We'll keep the generators operating for power until my demise. The Nautilus that has served me so faithfully for 40 years will now serve as my tomb. This is my last entry." It was signed Cameron Amherst. Meanwhile, Pitt and Giordino were poring over the massive engine with its distinctive 19th-century fittings, valves, and unfamiliar mechanisms, many of them cast and polished in brass. "What do you make of the design?" Giordino asked. "My best guess is that it's a combination of massive electrical energy and a rudimentary form of magnetohydrodynamics." "So Amherst created the concept 140 years before it was rediscovered. He didn't have the technology to run the seawater through a magnetic core kept at absolute zero by liquid helium. That wouldn't be produced commercially for another 60 years. So he used a kind of sodium converter. It wasn't nearly as efficient, but it was good enough for his purposes. Amherst had to compensate by relying on massive electrical energy to produce enough generating current to turn the propeller at an efficient rate of speed. Then it would seem likely that Egan used Amherst's engine as a base for his own designs. It must have proven an inspiration for him." "A phenomenal piece of work," said Giordino, appreciating the ingenuity behind the huge engine. "Especially when you realize that it propelled the Nautilus into every corner of the undersea world for 40 years. Pitt roused himself out of bed, slipped into a robe, and helped himself to a cup of coffee brewed by Sally Morse. He wanted to remain in bed for most of the morning, but Sally and Kelly were leaving. After testifying before Lawrence Congressional Committee and giving depositions to the Justice Department, Sally was warmly thanked by a grateful president and released to fly home and resume her duties as chair of Yukon Oil. When Pitt swayed sleepy-eyed into the kitchen, Sally was unloading the dishwasher. "I never thought I'd hear myself saying this, but I'm going to miss having you and Kelly underfoot." Kelly breezed into the kitchen wearing an ivory-knit sleeveless sweater and blue cotton shorts. "I'm almost sorry to leave this museum to man's folly," she quipped. "What are your plans?" Pitt asked. "I'm setting up a philanthropic foundation in Dad's name. Then I plan on donating the paintings and other art treasures to museums."
"And the hoard of silver and gold?"
"Some of it goes to build and finance the Elmore Egan Science Laboratory, which will be run by Josh Thomas, who plans to recruit the finest young minds in the country to come on board. Most of the rest will go to charities."
Sally stepped over to Pitt, hugged him, and kissed his cheek.
"Goodbye, Dirk Pitt. It was a privilege knowing you."
Kelly kissed him full on the mouth.
"When will I see you again?"
"Not for a while. Admiral Sandecker intends to keep me busy and out of mischief for a long time."
Lauren stopped by to spend the weekend with Pitt. They enjoyed a casual dinner of pasta with spinach and prosciutto that Lauren made, trading sarcasms and little jabs between them. It was a regular routine between two people of equal wit and intellect.
"Are your hearings about over?" he asked.
"Tuesday is the final day. From then on, the Justice Department takes the high road. My job is done."
"What does Justice have in store for Zale's cronies in crime?"
"The Cerberus cartel members will be indicted. Every agent in the Justice Department is working overtime to build cases against the thousands of bureaucrats and elected politicians who were known to have taken bribes. The consequences of this scandal will be felt for a long time."
Pitt stared into his wine as he swirled the contents around in the glass. So where do we go from here? She touched his hand lightly with her fingers.
We go on as before.
You in Congress and me under the sea, he said slowly. A soft look came into her violet eyes.
I believe it was meant to be that way.
So much for my illusion of becoming a grandfather. She pulled her hand away.
It hasn't been easy competing with a ghost.
Summer. He said the name as if he were seeing something far in the distance.
You've never quite gotten over her.
Pitt came around the table and kissed her lightly on the lips. I have a lovely, wonderful woman, and don't appreciate her the way I should. At that tender moment, Pitt's door buzzer sounded. His brow raised, and he turned and peered into the monitor of the video security camera. The image of a young man and young woman filled the screen. They were standing at the door beside a pile of luggage. Lauren went down to send them away as Pitt relaxed and finished the pasta. He was just taking a final sip of wine when Lauren's voice came over the intercom.
Dirk, I think you should come down.
There was something in her tone that struck him as peculiar. He dropped down the spiral staircase and walked past his collector cars to the entrance door of the hangar. Lauren was talking to the young couple. They both looked to be in their early 20s. There was a distinct presence about the man. His hair was black and wavy, and he was a good inch taller than Pitt. His build and weight seemed nearly identical to Pitt's. The eyes were also a mesmeric opaline green. He gazed more deeply at the man's face and stiffened. It was as if he was looking into a magic mirror that reflected himself when he was 25 years younger.